Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Texas Book Festival, and in particular to this session, which concerns the book Inequality and Instability by Dr. James K. Galbraith, A Study of the World Economy Just Before the Great Crisis. My name's Greg Curtis, and I'm here to talk during the session with Dr. Galbraith. Jamie K. Galbraith holds the Lloyd M. Benson Jr. Chair in Government Business Relations and is a professor of government at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He has degrees from Harvard and Yale. He's the author of 7 books and directs the University of Texas Inequality Project. As an example of his thinking, I would like to quote Dr. Galbraith on his own profession of economics. Leading,
I know what's coming.
Leading active members of today's economics profession, the generation presently in their 40s and 50s, have joined together into a kind of Politburo for correct economic thinking. As a general rule, as one might expect from a gentleman's club, this has placed them on the wrong side of every important policy issue, and not just recently, but for decades. They predict disaster where none occurs. They deny the possibility of events that then happen. They offer a rape is like the weather fatalism about an inevitable, in quotes, problem, pay inequality, that then starts to recede. They oppose the most basic, decent, and sensible reforms while offering placebos instead. They are always surprised when something untoward, like a recession, actually occurs. And when finally they sense that some position cannot be sustained, they do not re-examine their ideas. Instead, they simply change the subject. So, as you can see, Dr. Galbraith is rather shy and retiring. But I'm hoping today that to get him to tell us what he really thinks. Inequality and Instability is from the Oxford University Press, and of course that's what we'll be discussing today. So my first question is this. Inequality, what kind of inequality are you talking about in this book, and how is it measured?
Well, let me, Greg, thanks for that introduction, but just to clarify one particular point, this was a comment that I wrote actually in 2000, so now 12 years ago. So when I referred to the generation in their 40s and 50s, it was my generation that I was talking about, the group that had not yet reached my present extreme age. This book, Inequality and Instability, is actually the product of a working group and a research project that's been underway here at the University of Texas now for 16 years, and involved the contributions of a great many of my really first-rate students. So I wanted to say that first of all. You ask, what is the essence of the contribution of the book? It is about the measurement of inequality, measurement of economic inequality, particularly income inequality, and especially that part of income inequality, which is the inequality of pay, the inequality of rewards for work. The problem that we faced in approaching the subject and trying to cast some new light on it was that the evidence, the body of fact on which that was available to base argument and inference and historical narrative on was extremely weak. It was extremely bad, full of gaps, full of inconsistent measures, full of measures which were frankly not plausible. So what we had to do was to work out a way to actually come up with a systematic set of measures that were consistent through time and comparable across countries in order to provide a kind of background body of information on which we could write, I could write a credible book. And this is in a sense the product of that work. I'm happy to go on to your next question, which will elicit from me what it was all about and what we found.
What was it all about? And what did you find?
what we found was that economic inequality, inequality of incomes, inequality of pay around the world very closely related to, let's call it global financialization, to the rising role of credit markets, banking institutions in economic activity. Something which is very pronounced over the last 30 years, let's say in comparison to the 30 before that. And the result of this really beginning in the late 1970s, but heavily in the early 1980s, is an extraordinary increase in inequality around the world. It begins with the debt crisis of the early 1980s in Latin America, Africa, parts of Asia, expands through Central Europe, the former Soviet Union, as those regimes crumbled in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and goes on to Asia, and especially to China in the 1990s. And everywhere that you see rising inequality, you also see a rising share of income being taken by financial institutions, a rising share of activity running through credit. And what that suggested to me is that inequality and the instability of an economy based entirely on private credit, heavily on private credit, are two very closely linked phenomena. And you can see this very, 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 very clearly in the case of the United States, which of course is a, from our point of view, a leading example. It also happens to be the country that we're living in. And I can talk about that if there is a question to be asked about it.
Yeah, let's do, but I'm not sure, can you explain what you mean by inequality? Is this inequality that a lawyer in Minneapolis, heaven forbid, should make less money than a lawyer in New York, or is it what are the comparisons that make them unequal, make inequality?
It's, you know, in some sense, it's a summary measure of the that covers the whole of economic activity and economic life, and gives you a sense of what is the income gap between those who are the best paid people in the society and those who are less well paid. And that is something which one can measure in a number of different ways. I think the technical details would be, they would take up all our time here and not be worth the trouble. What we were able to do was to come up with a set of consistent measures that were based upon information that was very readily available. Readily available from, let's say, the United Nations, which collects industrial statistics around the world, readily available in Europe from their European Statistical Agency, Eurostat, at the level of regions within countries. For the United States, you can do this measure on the basis of tax records. You can do it on the basis of employment and earnings, industrial and employment categories. The characteristic of it is that we're taking economic categories, whatever they may be, and using that as a kind of a lens that enables us to take a snapshot of what the state of economic inequality actually is. So yes, your two lawyers would figure in to this measure, but more broadly, it's inequality across regions, inequality across industries, inequality across economic sectors. And the beauty of that is that the information set is very broad. It's reasonably accurate, and it enables you to pick out what the actual driving forces behind, let's say, a rise in inequality actually are.
Well, talking now about the United States, what are some comparisons in inequality between present day and 10 years ago, 20 years ago, so on? Are there trends that are clear to see?
Sure. When you look at inequality of incomes in the United States, one of the things you find is that it tracks very closely the movement of the stock market. Right? No big surprise. The dominant change in the income distribution is in the relative incomes of the very rich, of the very wealthiest Americans who happen to hold the largest share of corporate equities, of stocks, and whose income is dominated by capital gains, stock option realizations, and the income that flows to, let's say, new firms from their IPOs or their venture capital. And this is a very small number of people. And if you look at it in the 1990s, for example, you find that it's also concentrated in a very small number of places. And you can measure this across the counties of the United States. And the one question we asked was, suppose you take out the one county that contributed the most to rising inequality between, let's say, 1990 and 2000, what county do you suppose that would be? It's Manhattan, New York, New York, right? Which is, of course, where the financial centers are, where Wall Street is. And if you take that county out of the picture, the overall rise in inequality maybe is 20% less than it actually was. And if you take out four more, and they are King County in Washington, Seattle, Microsoft, Bill Gates, plus Santa Clara, San Mateo, and San Francisco in Northern California, then the rise in inequality falls by half. And if you take out 10 more, or 11 more, I think the top 15, it practically all goes away. So what you're seeing is the flow of incomes in that particular moment that runs through the financial markets to the tech companies is the driving thing between rising income inequality that goes to a peak in 2000. Then it comes down a bit with the NASDAQ crash. It goes up again in the middle 2000s. And where do you think the big center of rising income is in at that particular moment, 2003, 2004, 2005? It's basically one spot in the country. It's a handful of counties surrounding Washington, D.C. What's going on there? Well, we have a big increase in military expenditure, big increase in government spending generally, under, needless to say, a conservative Republican administration, but it's going to war. And the war expenditures are booked heavily in the counties surrounding Washington, Northern Virginia, suburban Maryland. And then if you look again in the late 2000s, 2007, just before the crash, what do you think pops up? Southern Florida, Southern California, Northern Florida. And the various spots where you have major construction associated with the real estate boom just before the crash. Lots of subdivisions being built to which people are not actually moving because the mortgages on them were fraudulent in the first place. But there was construction activity and income booked in those areas. So the method enables you not only to see the movement of inequality, but also to pick out just almost exactly where in the country it's happening, and just by eyeballing it, you can tell yourself a pretty persuasive story about why.
Do you find this phenomenon also in other countries? Are there small regions where that contribute over heavily to the inequality in that country?
It's almost, I won't say it's a universal phenomenon, but it's very common. We have very detailed information, for example, from official sources in China, which give you income and pay, really, payrolls booked by province and municipality and by economic sector. And you can clearly see that a very large share of this very big increase in inequality in China is three places. It's the province of Guangdong, which is a big place, and it's the city of Shanghai, and it's the city of Beijing. And if you go there, it's not hard to see why. The scale of the construction of the financial activity in those two cities is just astonishing to the eye. And Beijing, it just goes up until 2008, which then they held the Olympics. They had the Olympics along with a massive real estate boom, something very familiar to the United States, right? And with very similar effects on the structure of incomes in China.
So the other part of your title is instability. So how does the inequality in pay contribute to instability? What do you mean by instability to begin?
Well, I think instability is what we've all experienced. It's the risk of a major crash in economic activity as the result of the failure of the financial institutions. And I think the association between the two is that the inequality measure is really picking up the financial drivers of a credit boom. And when it goes up to high levels by historical standards, that's a sign that you're in trouble. I'm casting about for a good metaphor for this, and this one isn't in the book because I didn't think of it soon enough. It's like, you know, you're at a dinner party and you think of a really great rejoinder to some remark, but you think about it, you know, on the in the elevator on the way out. The idea I had was that these measures are rather like a measure of blood pressure. Right? There's a healthy range. When you're within the healthy range, lower is better. Too low is not so good. Right? Zero is something you find in the graveyard. It's it's really a bad sign. In fact, you don't see it in any living entity. But the real issue is when the number starts going up. And when it goes up past the healthy range, that's a sign that you're heading for trouble, that you're heading for a crisis. And I think you can see that in the way these measures behave. Not just, you can clearly see it in the U.S. I mean, we're a very, very transparent case. But you can also see it in other countries around the world.
Can you see this historically in terms of the economic experience of the late 1920s and early 30s, for instance, or other times?
The data that I've generated don't go back that far, except in some studies for the United States, which are not actually in this book, came out earlier. But the answer to that is yes, you can see it. You can see it in the run-up to financial crises in the period that we do cover from the 60s onward. And it's really pretty clear.
So, are there solutions to this inequality that would therefore, one presumes, increase the stability? Increase the stability of the economy.
Well, I think there are. I think if we look back to how we dealt with the great financial crash of the late 1920s, stretched out into the depression of the 1930s, we have the model for appropriate measures. And they are, first of all, to stabilize the incomes and the household balance sheets of the whole population. That's the thing that should be dealt with first. What Roosevelt did was, in the depths of the Depression, he created the Social Security system. He established something called the Homeowners Loan Corporation that helped people stay in their homes if they couldn't continue to pay their mortgages. He, of course, created a vast network of employment programs, which did an amazing amount of construction around the country, including the laying the basis for the industrial development of the South, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Lower Colorado River Authority, and many, many other projects of this kind. And he established the Fair Labor Relations Act and the minimum wage. All of this in the teeth of the Depression. Now, we actually have those institutions now. And the question facing us is, do we preserve and strengthen them? We don't have to invent them, most of them. We don't have to invent them. The question is, do we preserve and strengthen them, or do we throw them away? That's a question that's going to be facing us right after this election, no matter who wins it. It's going to be the question, it seems to me. You already see squadrons of corporate CEOs writing joint statements about how it's important it is to cut the budget deficit, by which they mean cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, above all. And I think that is the kind of thing that goes in exactly the opposite direction. It sets up some accounting goals, some reduction of budget deficits in some future forecast, over and above stabilizing the basic income of the population as a whole. But if you destabilize the population, if you allow the financial crisis to morph into an attack on social insurance schemes, then on our basic structure of social insurance, then you are going to severely aggravate the human effects of the financial crisis.
Are there other countries that are worse in this regard, to put it one way? For instance, do we in the zone where the euro is the currency, is that leading to greater instability there?
There's a huge difference between the U.S. And the eurozone. And the difference is that we have a very substantial central government that acts to stabilize our national economy on a continental scale. Right? And that is the reason why in the crisis, we suffered a 10% loss of employment, 10% loss of production, but incomes only went down a couple of percentage points. There was a huge increase in federal support payments and a huge reduction in federal tax burdens on private households as their incomes fell. And those two things meant that, on the whole, while we were much better off before the crisis than afterwards, the country didn't fall apart. The schools are still functioning by and large. The healthcare system, for what it's worth, is still functioning by and large. State and local governments have been stressed, but they haven't been busted flat. What's happening in the eurozone is very substantially more serious, because at that continental level, there's only maybe 1 or 2% of GDP, not 22 or 23%, passing through the central mechanism, through the European Union. And the effect of that is that large parts of the eurozone are not being rescued at all, not being stabilized. And you have a 25% unemployment rate in Spain, which is driving the Spanish population to a real depth of anger and frustration that we simply are not, it's not something that, it's beyond what we're observing here for all the stress that we've seen here. And if you look at Greece, Greece is falling apart. Greece is a small country which in this situation is actually being destroyed. It's a country which had many problems before the crisis. All that, what is said about a bloated public service and a patronage-based political system and massive tax evasion, particularly at high-income people, is all true. But the fact is, it did have a healthcare system, did have a school system, did have universities, did have a transportation system, and these things are being wrecked. I don't know if you saw the story in the Times about the woman in the Greek, came to the Greek medical system, of breast cancer, who had a tumor that had broken through her skin. It's something I hadn't seen there in a long time, but she had not had the means to seek treatment under a system that was, until a year or so ago, a universal health insurance system. And so, in an environment where you don't have institutions which are strong enough to buffer the financial crisis, and you have a political leadership which has got all the wrong ideas, and even if it didn't have the wrong ideas, it's got a very powerful, in the case of Germany, electorate which is full of wrong ideas, which is pushing them in the direction of wrong ideas. That is a situation which is heading toward, I think, a major explosion sooner or later. If you talk to people in Greece, and I do, they already worry about the arming of militias, essentially neo-Nazi groups being given authority to patrol in immigrant neighborhoods. Things which are really brutal and ugly are happening very close to the surface in parts of Europe at the moment.
Obviously, so much depends on the election, but if you, independent of that, if whomever would, and the whole populace of the United States would come, and Dr. Galbraith, what should we do? You said we don't need to reinvent everything. Maybe there's some things we need to invent, and maybe there's some things we need to improve about what we're already doing. What would you recommend in terms of our policies?
First of all, I would strengthen Social Security, and I would fight off all efforts to cut back Social Security benefits either immediately or in the future. This is a scare campaign which is going to do enormous damage if it succeeds. I would have moved Medicare up to 55. Just to take the pressure off companies and take the pressure off older workers who much higher likelihood of having major health problems. That would have been a sensible emergency step. I would I would raise the minimum wage. I would raise it quite substantially. The British, actually, here's an experiment which has been tried and worked. The British, who did not have a minimum wage until quite recently, have instituted one. They raised it a number of times. It's now substantially higher than ours. They discovered it didn't cost them any jobs at all. It did help restructure and strengthen the lower end of their workforce, but contrary to what the economists were telling them, it didn't cost jobs. And apparently the rise in the minimum wage has become uncontroversial in Britain. Not even the Tories want to roll it back, which, considering they want to roll everything else back, is really quite a remarkable thing. What else would I do? There was a very interesting idea on housing that a friend of mine in Washington named Dean Baker came up with a few years ago, which was to establish something called the right to rent, which is to say, if you got foreclosed on your home and you wish to stay in it, and you could pay a fair rent that was, say, set by a local judge or a board, that you could stay in it for, say, 3 or 4 years and buy it, have the right to buy it back after a certain period of time. And that wouldn't necessarily help everybody who's in a foreclosure situation, but it would help stabilize neighborhoods, and that's an important step. Is what happens, of course, when people are thrown out of their houses and the houses themselves decay, is that the value of everybody else's house gets caught up in a kind of downward spiral. That's a step that could have been taken. It wasn't taken because the administration placed a priority on rescuing the banks, which it did very effectively. But the problem here, and the thing to have to recognize, I think everybody recognizes it now, in fact, is that rescuing the banks is not the same thing as rescuing the economy. The banks can be there. It doesn't mean they're going to lend. It doesn't mean they want to lend. It doesn't mean they want to lend for business activity, for employee job-creating activity, or to households. And they won't do it, in fact, and long as the economic environment is one which is heading in the wrong direction, heading in a downward direction. So one needs to have a way of getting funding out to the economy that goes around the banking institutions that have become essentially dysfunctional in the 4 years since the debacle.
I'd like to open to questions.
Sure, by all means.
Questions from the audience? Just
Jamie, why don't you put whatever you...
Go ahead.
So it sounds like you're very much in favor of Keynesian-type measures. Does that mean that you think the deficit doesn't matter, or do you think the deficit gets solved when people have more stability and are earning more, or what's your response to the people who are so concerned about the deficits?
The deficits will come down if and when there's a recovery of economic activity. Whatever you think about the deficit... The thing to recognize that is that cutting spending and raising taxes cures it on paper, but not in real life. And that's what, in fact, is afflicting the Europeans. They go get an austerity policy, and the austerity policy puts their deficit right on a track to meet what's called the Maastricht targets, 3% of GDP in a year or two. Massive, and they really get good applause from their creditors if they have a really tough policy that's going to get them there in a year. And guess what? They have another year of recession. And the economic activity goes down. And the deficit just goes up again. Doesn't recover at all. And then they come back and they have to do it again. And they just, it's a repeating cycle of essentially of self-destruction. The only thing that can bring the deficit, in fact, down is an improvement in economic activity that gives people more income and therefore gives the government a stronger flow of tax revenues. Now, does the deficit, in fact, as it is, are we going to be hurt in some way by running a large federal deficit? The answer to that question is no. We're not going to be hurt by it. We are going to run a large federal deficit until this problem is overcome, if it is indeed it is overcome. And because we are the United States, a very large country with a very liquid market in U.S. government bonds, we are going to continue to see what we have seen, that people with money are willing to lend to the U.S. government at very low interest rates for very long periods of time. And that is your surest sign that all this talk about deficits is really basically it's scare talk. It's not reliable. It's what they're saying, in effect, is that the markets are irrational. Because those 3% 30-year interest rates should not be there. But if the markets are irrational, why? Explain to me why we should pay attention to them. Sir.
I wonder if you could comment on whether there's a difference between disparity of income in situations where the disparity is caused by bubbles, which we've had a lot of, and maybe before we had real economic growth and productivity in the country. First, that's the first question. Secondly, I've heard that the amount of the income of the country that's funneled through Wall Street and our financial institutions as a percentage has been going up significantly. So could you comment on those two issues?
Well, the second point is clearly right. The banking sector is at the peak before the crisis was around 40% of corporate profits and about 10% of all wages. And it just baffles me why anybody thinks we need to have a banking sector as big or as rich as that. That is a kind of a fixed cost charge on the whole economy. It comes out of profits that would otherwise be earned by small and medium businesses and that might be used to employ people. So it's a major structural problem, and it's gotten worse because the approach to the crisis has been to allow the big banks to buy up the small ones. And there are, by the way, speaking of books, a number of really good books detailing this by officials actually of the Bush administration. Sheila Bair's book has just come out. It's called, got it on my desk, the title will come to me, Bailout by Neil Barofsky, who was the Special Inspector General of the TARP. Sheila Bair's book is called Bull by the Horns. These are good accounts of how responsible officials found themselves in trying to ward this off unsuccessfully. On your first question, since the late 1960s, I would say, our economic growth has been heavily dependent on private credit cycles, which you can call bubbles. I don't like the term bubble. It's kind of has a connotation of innocence about it, which I think one has to be wary of the metaphors that one is being fed. But you can call it bubbles if you like. I think it was clearly better to have a tech bubble in which we were funneling money to, you know, kids with big ideas about what to do with the internet than it was to have a bubble that was based upon fraudulent subprime mortgages, which was the end of the end game of the of this whole system. You could write off the failed business plans at the end of the internet boom as something which maybe more sober banker would not have given a loan to Webvan, for example, but it's not the greatest disaster. But the mortgage debacle undermined the integrity of the entire world financial system, and not just here. It also destroyed the credibility of American banks with foreign investors who had bought these securities, these residential mortgage-backed securities, and it destroyed the credibility of the ratings agencies. It destroyed everything that was supposed to work about the financial system. And I think in 2009, the Obama administration really fell short in failing to come to grips with this, in letting the expectation develop that the financial sector could carry a recovery. It couldn't. This was a sector, the reactor had melted. It wasn't just like the engine was out of gas or something. The whole underlying structure had been run into the ground in a way that could not be simply restarted and here you say Keynesian policy. The Keynesians have been at least associated with the idea that if you just poured more gas into the engine, you could get it going again, the so-called stimulus program. And I part company with that version of Keynesianism. I don't think it's true. I think you need to have a very, very substantial structural reform at the core of the system before we're really able to see a little bit of optimism in the economic future.
Let me ask, in the post-war period in the 50s, wasn't there a fairly big economic expansion in the country that didn't end with a crash?
That's correct. And in the 50s, a number of things were quite different from today. For one thing, energy was cheap, and it was substantially domestic. So we were not running into a resource constraint, which is mainly in economic terms, but constraint on profits. Oil prices go up and the import bill goes up, and that comes directly out of corporate profits. And in the 50s, we had a strongly regulated banking system, which had a very large element of public direction. Now, the whole savings and loan industry was set up in those days to underwrite mortgages on a very restrained and sober basis. And one could go through the whole, you know, the structure of the, it was also an enormous competitive industrial advantage, which was bound to go away eventually. Of course, it was something we had to cope with, was that other countries would follow the same industrial path, Europe and then Asia, and that has happened. So the conditions were, in fact, much better, and the governance was also much better in those years. Sir?
It sounds like you're able to establish a correlation between financialization and inequality, and I was wondering what your theory is about that relationship of causality. And the second one on that is, what is the role of inequality? Is it the cause of instability, or is instability the cause of inequality?
Yeah, both excellent questions. The theoretical issue here is, let me just say, what are the alternative theories that are floating around? With respect to the United States, there basically have been two ideas about the rise of inequality that have had a lot of currency amongst economists, and have prompted in part that comment that Greg read. One of them is that inequality is simply a result of technological change, and is something which is associated with the increasing demand for skill. And the implication of that, unstated in most respects, is that if you're falling behind, it's your own fault for failing to keep up your education, right? Well, this is a very dubious story, because in fact, the number of people who are able to benefit from the very high incomes associated with the tech boom, the people who are actually creating those technologies, very small number. Look at the employment of Microsoft or Apple, and you're talking a few tens of thousands of workers. It's, you know, a tenth the size of a reasonable automobile company. And the number of people you can train to be competitive for those jobs is enormous, but a lot of them will end up driving taxis. So that was one theory. A second theory had to do with trade. And trade did play a role, but the problem there is that as manufacturing declines as a share of total income, trade doesn't affect most American workers. It's, you know, most American workers are in services or in construction or in the professions, things which are going to be there whether a particular line of manufacturing activity is here or not. So being able to establish that there was a close relationship with financialization may be establishing the obvious. But that's always a useful thing to do in a profession where denying the obvious is the number one activity. Second part of your question, what is the association actually? Is it a cause or is it an effect? I tend to think of it as two sides of the same coin. And I find it hard to be clear about, to have a clear line about cause or effect. The two things go together so closely that I think of the inequality measure as almost an index of an increase in instability. I think that's the useful way of thinking about it. And again, the blood pressure analogy is useful. Blood pressure is something which may have a deeper cause. It may not. It may not have an identified deeper cause. And you can treat it, and people do treat it, without necessarily having distinguished what the specific cause is. And it's useful to do that and helps stabilize people's health. There. Could you speak? I got about Germany and Greece. Could you speak up a little bit?
Yes. A lot of blame is being placed on Germany for what's going on in Greece. And given
Well, Germany is in the central position in Europe. It's the one country which, beginning in 2000, started running a very large trade surplus, which meant that everybody else went into deficit and has ultimately got debt repayment problems. So in some sense, pointing to German policy as a key feature of what's going wrong in Europe is not wrong. A couple of other things about Germany, though, are worth noting. One is that Germany has, so far as I understand, Germany has not had the same kind of real estate or asset bubble that you've seen actually in Southern Europe. So how German housing prices haven't gone through the roof the way they have in, let's say, Italy, or the way they did in Spain. And German households have been actually hit with the very tough wage discipline. So their incomes are up much less than the incomes of the South. And the result of that is, while Germany as a whole is running this big surplus, ordinary voting Germans can see that they haven't got as rich in their personal accounts as some of their southern co-members of the Eurozone. And so they are quite bitter. And I think it's understandable that what's happened in Germany is an amazing backlash against the way the Eurozone appears to have functioned, with the result that even if Chancellor Merkel had a more pan-European attitude and policy, she couldn't very well implement it because she would be replaced as chancellor. There would be an uprising on her right, and that disciplines her position. I'm not going to criticize or defend her, but to say that she's a politician operating with a very small margin of maneuver. She's got these flaming right wingers in prominent positions at the Deutsche Bank, at the Bundesbank, for example, and in the policy advising community in Germany. So it's a very, very tough position to be in. And so I think in the end, the argument I would make is this is really a problem of the structure of the Eurozone, which they are most likely not going to be able to fix. I was just there. I was in Paris and in Rome, and then for a couple of days in Moscow, which is watching this from a distance. But I suggested to my audiences in Rome that there were two endgames in Europe. One was the Yugoslav model, not very far from Europe, right? One which ended very badly in territorial breakup and violence, and breakup within breakup, right? Which you can see happening with Catalonia and Spain, with the attitude of North Italy to South Italy, with the attitude of Flanders and Wallonia and Belgium. It's possible not only to have a breakup of the Eurozone, but a breakup of individual European countries, and this will not be a happy thing. This will be a very ugly, as I say, the Yugoslav model. And the other model is, to draw from another example right next door, the Czechoslovak model, which would be a negotiated separation into two functioning regions with operating on very different principles that would give South Europe independence from the German policy regime. And I think it would be extremely difficult to go there, the big obstacle being France, but it may be the only way to actually focus people's attention on a viable alternative is to start talking about it.
One more, we have time for one more short question.
Ma'am.
For example, spending on highways and bridges or infrastructure or someplace that money could be spent that would be spent effectively?
I'm reticent about laying out a big spending program. And here again, I have some differences with someone who's otherwise usually my ally, a guy like Paul Krugman, in that while we could, I think, do a lot of good with an infrastructure and an energy program, doing them right means doing them over a long period of time and not relying on the money to provide and not thinking that the money is going to bring 8 million people back, put 8 million people back to work anytime soon. So how can we get spending power out into the economy in a way which actually would move things along more quickly? I'd do two things. I'd support the public services of state and local governments and of the nonprofit sector. This is existing activity which is being cut in a lot of places, it should be expanded instead. There's no good reason why you should cut necessary public services, teachers, fire, police, parks, libraries, environmental services, at a time when you have large amounts of unemployment, just because the governmental units can't find money. Then the federal government can provide them with those resources and should. And the second thing I would do is I would cut the older working population a better deal on early retirement in Social Security. I would say, you can get the terms you would get at 62, you can get them at 59. The terms you could get at 67, you could get them at 62, for 3 years, say. And allow people who are presently at that stage of their working lives where they would like to retire but can't quite afford to have a sweeter deal, knowing that what will happen is they'll leave their jobs and their firms that that hired them will then go looking for younger workers who are presently having a hard time finding jobs. And I think that would do two things. It would allocate the existing body of jobs to a group of people who would appreciate them more and needs them more, and it would provide purchasing power in this segment of the population that's not presently there, allowing people to retire more comfortably than they otherwise would. And that's a simple, common sense kind of thing that would get spending power out to the population and doesn't require the government to be a lot quicker on its feet, more competent, better organized than it actually is. Doesn't require us to reinvent the New Deal, the Civilian Conservation Corps, to have a Harold Ickes on hand to do the WPA for us.
Thank you very much, Dr. Galbraith. We'll be in the book signing again. Thank you.